Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, summer draws to a close. There's a certain chill in the air, an urge to make the best of what's left of the season. You plan a trip to the country, to an old farm, a place on a river. You take a walk, visit with friends and strangers, listen to a handful of talks by really smart people about their life work, and enjoy a meal prepared by a Seattle chef. That's the general idea for the Smoke Farm Symposium, and it's as good as it sounds. Smoke Farm is operated by the Rubicon Foundation. Their mission since 1993 has been, quote, to create an alternative, non-traditional, non-repressive, self-governing community to promote education and cultural creativity. Thanks to Stuart Smithers and Brendan Kiley for inviting us up to record part of their ongoing project. The 8th Annual Smoke Farm Symposium took place on August 27th. It featured talks by Professor Tanya Erzin, writer and filmmaker Charles Mudede, NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory scientist Ken Williford, and historian and MacArthur Fellow Mott Green. We're presenting segments from each speaker here. You can hear the full versions of their talks on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Here, Brendan Kiley introduces Professor Tanya Erzin.
Well, welcome. I'm so glad you made it out. This is actually one of my favorite moments of every year, is the moment before the talks begin at the Smoke Farm Symposium. It's our 8th year. One of the projects that's come out of the symposium is this journal, Black Box, A Record of the Catastrophe, which includes essays by several people who've spoken at the symposium before, and some you'll hear from today. And there are copies for sale or perusal, if you like, around the farm today. So I want to introduce Tanya Erzin, who is one of the contributors to Black Box. She's a writer, a professor at University of Puget Sound. She focuses on religion, sexuality, prison issues. Some of the books she's written have been Straight to Jesus, about the ex-gay movement, Fanpire, about Twilight fans. She's written about police brutality, and she's got a new book called God in Captivity, The Rise of Faith-Based Ministries in an Age of Mass Incarceration. She's a Soros Fellow. She's also written for The Nation, Guernica, Boston Globe, very prolific person, a great thinker, and a great friend to Smoke Farm. So I'd like to welcome Tanya Erzin.
We live in a very interesting moment for a variety of reasons, but particularly in terms of criminal justice reform. We have a consensus across the political spectrum right now that there is a massive crisis, and mass incarceration in our country is a crisis. So you have groups like the ACLU working with the Koch brothers. You have Newt Gingrich and Paul Ryan and others talking about prison reform, in addition to progressives, liberals, and people farther to the left. And so when it comes to the if you want to talk about the sort of uniquely American nightmare, nothing really beats our carceral system. And I'm going to just show you this slide, because many of you probably know this, but I think it's important to just reiterate this over and over. We have 5% of the world's population and 25% of its prisoners, and we have one-third of all the world's female prisoners in the United States. So the young woman who used to work for me doing the college program just is now living in Copenhagen, and she wrote to me and said, I tell them about our college program, and they're very confused, because there are probably about 10 women in all of the country in prison there. And they said, is your college program for teenagers? And she says, no. And she says, how could somebody get to be 20 years old in the United States and not have a high school or college degree and then end up in prison? How is that possible? They were genuinely really confused. I think that the other thing about the statistic is that most people are really unaware that we have essentially a human rights catastrophe occurring around us, invisible to some and to others, in our prisons, in our jails, but also in our immigration detention centers, which are growing. So the women's prison where I work is so overcrowded that they're shipping women to a jail in Yakima, which is not equipped to hold anybody for any amount of time. The conditions there are horrid, and they're just shipping 50 people at a time because they just have this massive overcrowding, and they can't imagine an alternative, which might be, why are we sending so many people to prison in the first place? So how the left and the right views this crisis really differs, and I think it really matters, because people on the right, and I'm talking in broad terms here, see the prisons as akin to an inefficient public institution. Overbloated bureaucracy, we spend too much money on them, and thus all of these states are having essentially a fiscal crisis. People on the left, progressives and liberals, talk about prisons in terms of the immense racial disparity in terms of who goes to prison, the sort of scandal of locking up so many people for such long periods of time in such abysmal conditions. And really, others question the basis of punishment, this kind of question I asked you at the beginning, which is not only what is the purpose of a prison, but why do we punish? How do we punish, and to what end do we punish? So I'm interested today in discussing with you how these strands of prison reform in many ways end up reproducing the prison, and in my talk I called it the prison beyond the walls. Particularly this emphasis on cost saving and our sort of faith in new technology that will somehow address mass incarceration, how it ends up creating other forms of the prison, whether it's surveillance, control, policing. And because I, as some of you who know me, I teach a class called the Apocalyptic Imagination, and I'm really interested in apocalyptic fiction and artists who imagine sort of the apocalyptic, how there's dystopian and utopian aspects to this technology. So some of the proposals from these coalitions, like the one I showed you, let's see if I go back. This first slide has one of the Koch brothers, Newt Gingrich. I think that's, they've worked with Cory Booker. They've worked with the ACLU. And what they're basically arguing is that you can have things like community supervision. So instead of sending people to prison, they can be supervised in a program. We can divert them to a different program, a drug court or a drug treatment. We can develop new parole systems to manage people instead of putting them in prison. And my question is, do a lot of these new forms, these new sort of policies, end up merely expanding what I call the supervisory state? Does it just create new ways of controlling? And in what ways are they obviously ripe for abuse? If the goal, for instance, is to fill a private addiction program, right, or to make sure the private company administering parole stays in business, what incentive is there for people to get out of parole, to solve drug addiction, to get out of prison and stay out of prison, right? It's, as someone said earlier, it's a system that's self-replicating in many ways. The women's prison here in Washington actually recently just adopted a private drug addiction program called Therapeutic Community, and it's all over the country. And so now, this is just in the past week, so I'm thinking about this, they've taken a group of about 150 women, and they're going to double that, and they've created an entire unit where they live separately, they dress separately, they're not allowed to talk to anybody else, they have certain language and greetings they can use with each other, they have a whole system by which they confess, and other people sort of talk to them about their crime, they monitor each other, and this is really the trend in prisons, right, is to contract with these private companies, and this, there's a real belief that this is really the solution to having so many people in prison. And again, my question is, does this effectively address this problem of mass incarceration, or does it merely compound or supplement it? And I want to give you an example of a recent proposal by a liberal public policy professor from UCLA that has received a lot of interest from both the right and the left. And his name is Mark Kleinman. And he, one of the central problems with a lot of these reforms is that they address things like letting people out who have really long sentences for drug crimes or nonviolent crimes. But they haven't adequately thought about, what do you do about violent crime? What do you do about people that harm other people? So his proposal was that in order to deal with this issue and not compromise public safety, He would put people in specific housing by the government and then monitor them 24/7 instead of sending them to prison. And that by doing this, we could reduce our prison population by 80%. So we'd let them out before their sentences are up, place them in apartments rented by the government. They'd be monitored via webcam all the time, and they'd be assigned public service jobs. They'd retain their status as prisoners, and they'd be subject to a strict set of rules, things like curfew, drug use, geographic location, where they can and can't go, who they can associate with, and that they would be located in communities populated by what he calls fully free citizens, and they would function, in his words, as, quote, a prison without bars. So I stole my title from Mark Kleinman for today.
Next up, from the 8th Annual Smoke Farm Symposium, part of a talk given by writer and filmmaker Charles Mudede, titled Inhabitants, An Anthropology and Philosophy of the Global Migrant. Again, Brendan Kiley makes the introduction.
Welcome back, everybody. People are trickling back now. It's time for our second speaker of the day, Charles Mudede, who is a Zimbabwean writer and a filmmaker. I actually worked with him for many years at The Stranger, the weekly newspaper in Seattle, or one of the weekly newspapers in Seattle. His films include Police Beat, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, and Zoo, which showed at Sundance and the Cannes Film Festival. He's working on a new film called Now I'm Fine. He's directing it, and it's based on a performance at On the Boards by Ahamefele J. Oluo that was, I think, in the past year premiered there. He's a delightful person. So please welcome to the stage Charles Mudede.
To make this painless as possible. I debated for a long time whether I should read something or I should just talk about what I was going to read. I really hate reading to people. And so I'm going to do half and half is what it's going to be. And as I said, I'm going to talk about a project that I've been working on since about 2010. And it's a project I call a theorizing of people or groups of people that I call inhabitants. And the journey into this subject began really with a bunch of informal talks that I held at a table at HIDMO, and about 5 or 7 people would show up, and we'd talk about what I was reading at the time and how it might relate to fleshing out this this theory. So I wanted to sort of like give, sort of before I get started into it, I first want to just give some thanks to people who have been really helpful in this work, which is, and I could call it my big project. It's the one I think I'm going to die before I finish, and it'll be found in a suitcase or something, right? And there'll be just in notes, and everybody bitching about how it's incomplete, and you know what I mean. And I have that already, like fantasized, right? The hassle it'll cause scholars. The sentence that ends in the middle. I mean, you know what I mean? And stuff like that. You know, and so I've already have this projection of an immense failure that will change the way people think forever or something like that. But it has to be it has to be incomplete to be really good. And so I've been working on this for so long. And as I said, anybody who has these long projects, it's the one thing you know you just, as you try to finish. And sometimes you make ground. You get a rush and you finish some chapters and then you stop. And then you stop for a long time, and then somebody knocks and reminds you that you have to get back on this. Now, there's two people I want to really thank in my intellectual or in my library or my books library. Anyway, for really making this move in my mind, and it's Stephen Jay Gould, the evolutionary biologist, died in 2001, and Sarah Hardy. I think the most important evolutionary sociobiologist alive today. Her book, Mothers and Others, has had an enormous impact on me, and I refer to it constantly. In fact, the fact that she has brought feminism into evolutionary studies, evolutionary anthropology, has redefined the entire picture of that field. So those are the two sort of leading intellectual lights here. And the three directors who play a role, in the first two you'll see, the first is Mambeti, the Senegalese director who died sadly in 1998. He had a film called Hyenas, which I recommend you watch. It's one of the, I think it's the greatest African film ever made. Mambeti is Senegalese. The film was made in 1992. It is it's unsurpassed. It's based on a Swiss play called The Visit, which has been made into a film several times, but it is really African and profoundly so. So it's wonderful that one, I think, the most African movie ever made is based on a play by a Swiss playwright, right? And this is the beauty of the genius, I'd say, of Mbeti, Diop Mbeti. And then the other one is Pirogue, the pirogue. And what is it? No, it's Pirogue. It's Pirogue. It's a Pirogue. The Pirogue, which is a fantastic film that came out in 2003. 2013. It is by Touré, another Senegalese director. And this one is also in the Efflux. This one is the Equalizer. This one focuses on this particular film and its narrative. This one involves migrants crossing the Mediterranean. They're black Africans crossing the Mediterranean in a rinky boat or trying to get to Europe, to get through Fortress Europe. And there's something that happens on the way, and I get involved in what happens on the way. And so that's the second film. And the third one is District 9 by, I should say, almost a countryman. He's South African, or country person. I shouldn't be so British. Neil Boomkamp. My Afrikaans is never good, but I think it's Boomkamp. And he directed District 9. And that's the third version that I'm sort of late to turn over for Efflux. And again, if you remember, everybody remembers District 9. The movie is about a set of aliens who appear over Johannesburg. And they are desperate, they're hungry, and they end up staying in a sort of isolated neighborhood, a camp called District 9 that looks a lot like Soweto in the apartheid era, but the aliens look a lot like Zimbabweans who have fled across the border into South Africa looking for work. And so depending on who you are, I think if you're South African, you see, that's what we were treated like under white oppression. And if you see, if you're Zimbabwean, you see, those aliens are us. You know, because right now, Zimbabwe went through an economic collapse in 2001. And then everybody became pretty much an economic refugee. If you're young, you got out of the country, and there are two countries you went to first, or tried to get to first, South Africa, and then England. And if you're lucky, you went either to Australia or the USA. And it's to the tune of like 4 million Zimbabweans are now out of the country. And this is a country of 11 million people. So this demographic impact is going to change the future of this country, and certainly so. Anyway, a lot of the Zimbabweans left left the country around 2001, 2000, and moved to South Africa. And if you remember, there was a lot of xenophobic violence towards these Zimbabweans around 2008, and again, there was another outbreak in 2011. And it was black Africans in South Africa burning Zimbabwean businesses, attacking Zimbabweans. I don't know how they noticed them, but they did. I know how they noticed them. I'm joking. That was an inside joke. I can tell a South African from a Zimbabwean. I mean, I can. And I don't mean that in a racist way. I mean that in an honest way. The Zimbabweans were attacked, and if you watch the movie District 9, that's what happens, right? They're isolated. They have an economy, and they're attacked often by drunkards, and often they are black Africans. Although there is a white resentment as well about their arrival and their consumption of resources and this sort of thing. So District 9 plays the third part. And again, so that's the first part. Okay, second part. All right. See why this will never be done. The second part, why did I come with the name Inhabitants? Well, Inhabitants actually was a mistake. It was an accident. Sometimes I get tired and I decide to clean my apartment. And we're tired of life, I should say. And I blame everything around me, so I start to clean. And I was cleaning and I wanted to listen to some music. And then I decided, no, I'd like to... And I went to Lime, and Lime is a place you can go back in the days. You can go and get illegal music and download it. And then I just decided, what if I just listen to the poetry of Baudelaire? What if there's Baudelaire on Lime? And so I typed in Baudelaire, and sure enough, something popped up. And it wasn't the poetry of Baudelaire. It was actually a lecture delivered by a guy called Arnold Weinstein. And he was a professor, and he had an essay, a collection of essays called The Soul and the City. And in this collection was an essay, a lecture which he delivered about Baudelaire's poem, The Swan. And I loved this particular essay, this particular lecture. And in it, he was talking about the Haussmannization of Paris and how that transformed not just Paris, but also dislocated people. I went back and read The Swan very carefully because of this lecture, because in a way, it's the first poem dedicated to gentrification. It's the first gentrification poem in the history of the universe. We can actually say that Les Cygnes, right, The Swan, is the poem about the redevelopment of Paris and the displacement of people. And this is a poem about this displacement. And the swan is a figure of displacement, the exile, an exile in their own world. Anyway, in this essay, and I was so sad he didn't have a book. I really wished he had written a book, but he hadn't. But what he said instead was, he said, this displacement transformed people who were accustomed to their neighborhoods, to their small part of the city. It transformed them from citizen, citoyen, into inhabitants, right? Inhabitant, right? And I loved this, right? The displacement made them suddenly strangers in their own world, right? And that's what I liked about Inhabitants. The idea was that, and I kept with it, and I said, oh, shoot, this is it. Because what does it mean to be in a place where you have no, right? You're not a citizen. And most of us are not just living in places that we are citizens, we're no longer citizens, but we're also living in places where more and more we're losing our citizenship and becoming inhabitants, right? So that was sort of like the background for that. That was where I came with the title of Habitants. And then the second thing that happened to me was a lecture that was delivered in 2012. I found this on the web, and it was a lecture delivered by Andreas Calvayas. And he was, he's a political philosopher, and he's based in Columbia University, and he was delivering this lecture at London School of Economics, and it was on statelessness. And the characteristics, the features of statelessness with migrants. And he was trying to give a political picture as to what that means. What does it mean not to have a country and to be in a country and to demand your rights? That was his central question. What does it mean when you are, say, an illegal person without papers, sans papiers, in Paris, but you go and march? Right? And why he was asking this question is because people like Hannah Arendt, political philosophers like Hannah Arendt and philosophers like Agamben were sort of like had theories of statelessness. And they thought that basically if you don't have a state, you don't have a politics. You're denied political agency. Right? And so she was trying to theorize this thing where she would be like, Andreas. Kalevas was trying to theorize a thing, saying that, well, how is it possible that, you know, people who are illegal or undocumented still, you know, protest, sit-ins, marches, and at times, you could say, are more political than those who are citizens sometimes. Citizens, a lot of citizens don't go and vote or nothing, don't go and protest. They sit at home watching football all day, right? So these people are political because they have rights, yeah? And these other people who are fighting to work and so forth and so on, but don't have a state to represent them, are apolitical or have no politics, right? That's bizarre. So the question is, where is their politics? That's the big question he asked. Where is their politics coming from?
After a tamale lunch break and a swim in the river for some, NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory scientist Ken Williford took the stage to talk about his work and life in general.
Our next speaker spoke at the first symposium, Ken Williford. He is the deputy projects scientist for the NASA Mars 2020 mission, which he describes as the next Mars rover mission. He is also the director of the Astrobiogeochemistry Lab, known as the ABC Lab. He went to graduate school at the University of Washington, now lives in Los Angeles, and his research ranges, has a huge spectrum from the very small, such as microscopic fossils in the oldest rocks on Earth to find the origins of life, to the very large, the incomprehensibly large, looking for life potentially elsewhere in the cosmos. And Ken is also a great and longtime friend of Smoke Farm. So please welcome Ken Williford.
Thanks a lot, Brendan. And thanks, Stuart and Brendan. And thanks to all of you for coming here and having this symposium keep going year after year. As Brendan said, I love this place. I came here the first time, I think, about 17 years ago, and instantly fell in love with it. And it's, I would say, without much hesitation, it's my favorite place. And it's, of course, made up of the river and the fields and this kind of thing, the events, but primarily the people and the ideas. And so this event is really symbolic of that. For me, the ideas, which are what drew me to this place originally. And so it's been great. I try to come back at least once a year now. And this is I make this event my priority. And it's just been fantastic. I feel really blessed to have this as a touchstone in my life to keep coming back here. So thanks everybody involved in putting this together. So, Brenda did a nice job introducing my research, so I don't have to give you too much of an introduction to me as a person, but this is the question that I wanted to address today in the talk. What motivates life and the search for life beyond Earth? So this is the driving question today. And I'm going to break the talk into two parts. Part one is going to start with the latter part of the question, the search for life beyond Earth. And I'll just go ahead and tell you basically what I think the answer to this question is. That is, what motivates the search for life beyond Earth? And it's part of the reason I called the talk instinct. I think humans have an innate desire, an instinctive drive for exploration. So we've always wanted, it's part of what most fundamentally makes us human, is our desire to see new things, explore new things, be curious, move over the horizon. It's what we've always done. It's what we continue to do. There are, of course, many other practical reasons that we pursue planetary science, exploration of other planets. We develop new technologies through that. There's a national impulse to be the first to get there. There's a basic human impulse just to get there first, you know, to get to the new place. And then scientifically, what drives this more than anything is the desire to really understand the nature of life on Earth more fundamentally, and our own nature more fundamentally by doing that. So that's why I got into this work, is to understand the fundamental nature of life in the universe. That is has been the goal for me for a while. Not imagining that at some point along this road I will all of a sudden understand the fundamental nature of life in the universe, but that's the constant drive and question. And so, as Brendan said, I have sort of two main jobs. I work at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL, which is in Pasadena, kind of out on the edge of LA by the mountains. And there I am when I came to JPL, I became the director of the Astrobiogeochemistry Lab, which didn't exist until I came there. They just asked me to come there and build an organic geochemistry lab, and they said, come to JPL and work on Mars sample return. And so, as Charles beautifully explained in his talk, his long project, you know, that he may die before finishing, I'll knock on wood, I hope I don't die before, you know, finishing this one, but my long project, career-scale project, is Mars sample return. So, and that is because I come to it not as a Mars planetary scientist, but as an Earth scientist. I mostly study ancient Earth rocks, and for a long time, for as long as I've been doing science, I've been interested in looking in old rocks for signs of ancient life and just understanding how has life evolved on the planet and how did we get where we are today. And so we use various techniques in my lab to do that kind of work. We go to Western Australia and other places where especially ancient rocks are preserved especially well, and we look for evidence of ancient life in there. And it happens that the same techniques that we use to do that, explore the oldest record of life on Earth, are the same techniques you would use to look for evidence of life in very old rocks from Mars. And so that's the other half of my job, which is this deputy project scientist role. And what that means, so there's a project scientist and I, he's further along in his career at Caltech, his name's Ken Farley. And so Ken Farley and I, they call us the Kens, we sort of manage the science part of the next Mars rover mission. And there are equivalent to engineers who manage the engineering part. So they're building the robot and we are trying to help them understand choices they might make about what they might build on the robot and how that might affect the science that we want to do. And at the same time, helping the team that runs the 7 scientific instruments that are on the rover get all that done on time and on budget as best we can. So that's basically my job, and here's Mars. So I wanted to start really by telling you a little bit of the history of Mars exploration. So what is motivating this search for life on other planets. Turns out they had it figured out already in the late 1800s. There is life on the planet Mars. And so Professor Percival Lowell, recognized as the greatest authority on the subject, I'm just reading this article intro here, declares there can be no doubt that living beings inhabit our neighbor world. And the story goes on to talk about not only living beings. So we're currently, within NASA, we're not out there searching for intelligent life and complex conscious beings on Mars, but we think if we find something, it's likely to be microbial. It's likely to be microscopic. It might build itself into a form that we can recognize with our naked eye, but that would be like a wrinkly fossil microbial mat, something we call a stromatolite. It's made up of individual little bacterial cells that are smaller than what you can see with the naked eye. But back then, Percival Lowell, building on the work of Schiaparelli before him, the big thing then was identifying new canals. So the article talks about how many more new canals on Mars had been recognized by Lowell there from the telescopes, Earth-based telescopes in Arizona. It's kind of reminds me of reading stories about exoplanets today. So it's so-and-so discovered, you know, 32 new exoplanets that is planets that are outside of our solar system. You've all heard about that. That's how they talk about these new canals on Mars as evidence of intelligent life. So things have evolved since then. And in fact, in 1965, a JPL spacecraft, Mariner 4, flew by Mars and took this image. This is the first image ever transmitted back from deep space, having been acquired of another planet. So Mariner 4 flew by Mars, took a picture of its surface, and it sort of looks cratered and dead and lifeless, no canals there. And this changed the way people viewed Mars beyond what Lowell was talking about. 10 years later, this image, this series of images was transmitted back. First images that came back from the surface of another planet. So that last image was from a flyby way above the surface. These were sent back by a Soviet spacecraft, Venera 9, from the surface of Venus. An incredible achievement. This spacecraft survived for about an hour on the surface of Venus and gave us our first pictures from the surface of another planet. Maybe you recognize this guy, one of my scientific heroes, Carl Sagan, standing by out in Death Valley in the Mojave region, not too far from Pasadena, by the Viking lander, the Viking spacecraft, a year after I was born. The last two images I showed you were taken a couple weeks before I was born. So Carl is standing there explaining Viking, and Viking was the first spacecraft to send back images from the surface of Mars. So a major achievement. Viking also had as one of its principal objectives the search for life on Mars. And they were not looking for evidence of ancient life, which is our focus currently within NASA for various reasons. They were looking for life on Mars. What does Mars currently host life? They were thinking of it as probably microbial life, but they had a number of experiments designed to reach down, take up some Martian material, put it into the spacecraft, and make some measurements to see if things were actually living in the Martian soil or regolith. Most of the scientific community today believes that those experiments showed that there was nothing living in the soil, although the results were somewhat ambiguous, very difficult to interpret. And there are people who believe that that was a positive result there, but general scientific consensus is that it was negative and there was no life in the Martian regolith. So that really changed things. So science sort of figured, well, Mars does not appear to be currently inhabited. It's still incredibly interesting as a planetary neighbor, as a place to explore geologically, by which we might learn more about our own planet. And its non-living systems, certainly, and perhaps there's still some potential to investigate the evidence for past life on Mars, and maybe even current life. And this in 1996, this image was published. It'll be hard for those of you in the back to see. You might be raise your hand if you've seen this picture before. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. Not even half of you. This really transformed my field, which is astrobiology. It really launched my field. We had a field called exobiology before this, and we still have that. But now we more commonly use the word astrobiology, and that really started right around this time. In fact, Bill Clinton gave a press conference, and based on the paper in Science that had this image, said we have found evidence for life on Mars. And this is taken from an electron microscope, and it's really this sort of sausage-shaped thing that you see here. I don't show a scale bar here. It turns out that the diameter of this, or the width of this sausage-shaped feature, is about equivalent to the size of a single ribosome. So although there was a lot of excitement about this thing early on, and they thought maybe it's potential evidence for life on Mars, various factors have conspired to lead us to believe that indeed this is not evidence for life on Mars. It was found in a meteorite that was discovered in Antarctica near the Allen Hills region, so it's called the Allen Hills meteorites, the most famous of the Allen Hills meteorites, 84001, discovered in 1984, but this study was done in the 90s. Got everyone very excited, but it was ambiguous. And the search for evidence of life in rocks this old is always inherently ambiguous. But now we've come quite a long way in, you know, only 20 years of doing this kind of work. And it's a lot of what my scientific focus is to work to resolve that ambiguity.
You're tuned to Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Here's Brendan Kiley again to introduce historian Mott Green.
Thanks for coming back. I said we were going to have round two of science this afternoon, and that will be courtesy of Mott Green, who is writing an essay that will appear in the second volume of Black Box, which should be coming out in a few months. And he's working on a book now called Science Now, which he describes as being about the effects of neoliberal economic doctrines on the practices of the sciences since the 1980s, and that this talk will be a kind of pilot sketch of this book that he's working on now. He was the first ever symposium speaker here back in 2009. He's a historian of science. He is a MacArthur Genius Fellow. He's a professor emeritus at University of Puget Sound. He's written about computer modeling, European economic history, and, of course, about science. And one thing I love to tell people about Mott is that when he was giving his first talk here about science and the way scientists think and how they maybe need to think differently, there was a long conversation afterwards with the folks sitting where you are now, and somebody said something to the effect of, "So are you saying that scientists should all take psychedelics?" And he said, without even pausing, "Oh, yeah, yeah," which got a big laugh. But I believe he believes is also true. So I would like to welcome to the stage to talk about science now, Mott Green.
It wasn't really that dramatic, actually. The real thing was, it turned out that I was talking about the physiology of imagination, and it turned out in a survey of scientists, about 20% of working scientists admitted taking Ritalin off prescription in order to stay awake longer and do more science. And then somebody asked me if taking drugs, including psychedelics or Ritalin, was okay for scientists. And I said, if it turned out that they were really made them more productive, it probably should be mandatory in order to get an NSF grant. I'm a historian of science, which is to some people odd, but it's no odder than the history of music. There are people who play musical instruments and people who write about music, and then there are people who write about writing about music. So you just saw a real scientist, Ken Williford. So he's somebody trying to find order in nature. And what I do as a historian of science is I draw the box around Ken and his science, and look for pattern in the way that he looks for pattern in nature, right? It's a kind of a second-order deal. So, and my topic now is, I don't want to get too prefatory, I'll never get started. I'm interested in science since 1980. It's kind of, in some ways, it's an arbitrary time zero, in other ways, not arbitrary. There are two things that happened since 1980 that are everywhere evident in science. The first is the omnipresence of very powerful computers as an aspect of doing any kind of science at all, and access to that computing power as a precondition of being able to do significant science. Just absolutely have to do it. The other thing, which I think is really interesting, is the disappearance of the notion of science as something where a single person working alone, like Charles Darwin or Albert Einstein, does science, right? And so there are no more single-authored papers in science, none, except there are a few in cosmology and a few in pure mathematics. But if you go to Nature magazine, which is one of the weekly science magazines, Science in the United States, Nature in Great Britain, what you find is, and I did this by actually counting, an issue of Nature from 1950 and an issue of Nature from 2016 have the same number of articles in them, but they have eight times as many authors in 2016 as they had. So the minimum number of authors you find on any published scientific effort these days is two. The modal number, the most frequently observed number, is eight. And this year, in March of this past year, we arrived at, for me, a really interesting milestone, which was a paper in Science on an issue in fundamental physics on gravity, which had 1,013 authors. In fact, it had so many authors that the published pages with the names of the authors on them consumed more paper than the actual results of the paper itself. So that's an interesting thing for right there. That's right. That's why the time zero, the end of the individual author and the ubiquity of the computer. And then I got thinking also about, because I spent 40 years teaching, that very often the image of a human activity that we teach to students and the actual practice of that activity in the real world are very different. And the way I describe the book that I'm working on now, Science Now, to people who I talk about with it, is that, you know, when you were in eighth grade civics, you were taught about how a bill becomes a law. And my contention is that the actual practice of science today has as little to do with what we teach students science is like in school as your eighth grade civics class about how a bill becomes a law has to do with what goes on inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C. today. In other words, it's essentially zero. Okay? It's a theoretical construct of what might happen in an idealized world, but it bears no relationship to actual practice. Okay, so now, since 1980. Towards the end of the 1980s, a science journalist named John Horgan, who'd been used to interviewing scientists about thrilling theoretical breakthroughs and individual scientists talking to them about what they were doing and the new things they'd found out, noticed that the fodder for his journalistic efforts, major theoretical breakthroughs, was drying up. There weren't any. And so he went around and did a census of all the leading figures in science who would talk to him about this problem or this idea. And it's a very impressive list. It included, you know, E.O. Wilson, Richard Dawkins, Noam Chomsky, Stephen Gould, Freeman Dyson, Francis Crick, Ilya Prigogine, who you saw in Ken's talk, Stephen Hawking and others. They all agreed that the pace of theoretical novelty in science was slowing down. That there were no major theoretical breakthroughs being made and none in the offing. I'm not talking about no new science being done. I'm talking about nothing in physics that replaces quantum theory or nothing in genetics that replaces DNA, things like that, the kind of blockbuster theoretical developments we were used to in the 20th century.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. That's all the time we have for this sampling of talks from the 8th Annual Smoke Farm Symposium. You can hear each of the full talks individually on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon.